How did everyone go, of course it's normal for us to be just weaponizing misogyny for profit and watching women's mental health crumble before our eyes.
The noughties in particular were a period of institutionalized cruelty, and I think there was a real sense of nihilism in the air.
Talk to me about how you land on porn.
As an industry, porn is inherently and inevitably exploitative and expropriative of human value.
Hello and welcome to The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and this is a podcast about the deep values and driving principles of the people shaping our common life. My guests come from a huge range of political, metaphysical, and professional perspectives. And I am delighted to be joined today by Sarah Dighton, who is a critic, columnist for The Times and The Sunday Times, and the author of Toxic: Women, Fame, and the Noughties. Sarah, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to ask you just a, you know, like casual first question, which is about what are your deep values? I frame them as sacred values, but you can reject the premise of that if you like. What are the things that you have been trying to live by?
I guess the things that I think are really valuable and the things I've tried to stick by in my work are, it's important to be honest. It's important to be careful of other people, and it's important to be hopeful, I guess. I'm not sure whether that's a very thorough answer. It sounds a bit glib and hippie-ish, but I think those are probably things that I aim for, at least.
No, it's not glib at all. So my kind of working thesis is we don't really know what these principles are. They're kind of subconscious until someone tries to transgress them, until we hit a situation where we feel that like ick thing of I feel compromised or something's chafing on me. Does any like moments in your life arise in your memories where one or all of those principles have guided you?
I guess probably the big one professionally was the first time I came up against gender identity theory. And I was working as a journalist, and it wasn't a topic that I was writing about directly, but I wrote about women's rights and I wrote about reproductive issues. And this was in the early 2010s, around 2011, 2012, I would say. And there just started to be a growing pressure to use a kind of language about women's bodies, about reproduction, that I felt was opaque and impeding to helping to the cause of helping people understand what I was writing about. And it wasn't ever as though I was, subject to direct pressure from editors about this stuff. It wasn't as if I was being told directly what to write. But when you work in an environment, you kind of, you know, and understand what other people are thinking and what's in the air. And it was when I came across that for the first time, and I thought, I can't just go with this. I'm not, you know, against being kind and considerate towards trans people, but this particular set of beliefs that is being, incorporated into the work that I'm doing and the work I see other people doing, it's not something that I can just kind of breeze along with. So that would probably be the biggest and most difficult one that I've come across.
I'm always interested by how people's just like fundamental temperament shape their vocation and the choice that they make. How much was that like, I really don't want to have to push back on this, but I'm going to? And how much was it actually you're someone for whom it's quite energizing to have the sort of scrappy-do energy that I think some journalists have?
That's a good way of putting it. I think a lot of journalists do have that tendency to be a bit truculent, a bit cussed. It's a good thing to have, and you need people like that in a society who are interested in, you know, poking at the joints and seeing how things fit together and seeing what maybe doesn't work. So I would say that's certainly a part of my personality. I don't think of myself as particularly confrontational or particularly, a difficult person. But I'm sure other people think that I am. I guess I just, a long time ago now, I read an academic paper called The Erotics of Feminist Politics, I think it was called, by, I'd have to look it up, I haven't read it for ages. But one of the things that this paper was working towards was the idea that politics is about the coming together of disagreement. You can't have politics if you don't have disagreement. And that the experience of disagreeing should be productive and pleasurable, which is why the word erotics is in the title, even though like, I've been quoting this paper for about 15 years. And every time I quote it, I'm like, it's not actually about sex. It's not about sex. And that's always seemed to me a really important concept. The idea that to argue and debate about stuff isn't necessarily negative. It's actually quite important and positive and productive. And it's a component of, you know, all of my best relationships, actually, with my family, with my husband, with my friends. They are based on being able to disagree about stuff. And so I value that quite a lot. Actually, I don't know whether that does make me a scrappy-do person, but it definitely makes me a person who isn't afraid of disagreeing about stuff.
I love that. I have an interest in the expanding the concept of the erotic in spirituality, because I think there is a really interesting thing, particularly in the medieval mystics, of the sense of connection with the divine. That actually, I don't think my tradition is at all hostile to the erotic. It's just, it shows up in different ways. And for me, it's about connection. The connection is where the eros is. And sometimes that's sexual, but often it's not. It's about encounter. And so I'm going to go read that paper and add it to my...
I will. Well, I will look up who actually wrote it so you can find it. I've got a PDF of it knocking around. I think that's really interesting, because obviously connection is, does entail the idea of sexual connection as well as other kinds of connection. There's a great book by Andrea Dworkin called Intercourse, which is quite a punning title because it's basically about how men have represented sex in fiction. But the actual intercourse that's taking place is her in intercourse with these books. It's actually about this dialogue that she's having with them. It's a fantastic, fantastic book, like one of the most sort of formative books I've ever read, actually. But I think it's really interesting because if you think about these ideas of the divine, of connection, of pleasure and spirituality and sensuality, and you connect them to the time when Christian ideas are developing, it's a time of, pretty high risk, not just moral high risk or social high risk, but actual life and death high risk. If you have a pregnancy that is not a good pregnancy at a good time, you're suddenly in... you're in a mortal situation. And I think it makes a lot of sense that these ideas, these experiences that I think we tend to encounter in our lives now, mostly within a sort of secularized and sexualized realm, actually, they don't only belong to that. And these experiences of connection can be found in, lots of much more diffuse environments and through spirituality.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to come back to that when we talk about porn, because I have a theory about the sacralization of sex. But first, I want to hear about your story, where you've come from. Would you mind painting me a bit of a word picture of your childhood, maybe in your primary school years? Where were you and what was kind of in the air, ideas-wise, probably implicitly, not explicitly?
Oh, gosh, as a child. So I grew up in the countryside, had a very countryside upbringing, I now realise. Well, I have realised as I've grown up. I remember going to university and talking about being the May Queen and just being met with like a wall of incomprehension. Just like, what's a May Queen and why would you be one? It's like, actually, it's quite important. So
local rituals.
Yeah. So I grew up in a village in Rutland. My parents are not country people. My dad was a brewer at the time and we'd moved there for the brewery that he was working at. My mum was a teacher, so she was not teaching until I was about, I guess, 7 or 8 when she went back to work. But she'd always been really interested in religious studies. That was her main focus as a teacher. And so she, and because she worked primary, the sort of most rewarding places that she could go and work were not country C of E schools. It was an inner city school in Leicester with a mixed faith community, which was so interesting. And the colleagues of hers that I got to know and the children she taught, it was like incredibly rewarding to know those people and encounter those versions of faith at that point in my life. In terms of my actual school, it was very, you know, hymns, Advent, Vicar coming in and doing a bit of RE. Yep, Harvest Festival, very important. And mixed in with those kind of revived pagan traditions that I did not realise until I watched the John Betjeman film Metroland about 10 years ago. And he's got this whole bit in Metroland about how, so I think that was made in the 1950s. Yeah. There's this whole bit in Metroland about the deliberate revival of rural traditions as a way of kind of, you know, reinventing community in the post-war period. And I was like, that's me. That's me. That's my childhood. It was all a lie. These were not things.
Yeah, we thought these were ancient, unbroken lineages.
Yeah. God. It was not, you know, the latest in an unbroken lineage of May Queens. This is shocking. So there was that part of my upbringing. My parents are both atheist / agnostic. I think they'd probably say agnostic, but it's, you know, near as makes no odds. And then my family background on my mum's side was Salvation Army. So I had that connection of going to, you know, going to army services and, you know, that side of my family were like the whole uniform bit. All played brass instruments, like very, very full on if you're not used to it. And so those were the things that were kind of, you know, swirling around in my childhood.
And were you raised a feminist?
I was certainly raised around the expectation that what you probably think of as feminist values were the norm. I don't think it was ever something that I was told I should be or I must be. You know, my parents never, ever gave me any suggestion that I should be, you know, less than because I'm a girl. I remember this the other day, one of those real like, oh, that's who I was, childhood memories, being working my little workbook in class one at my school. So I would have been 5 or 6 and being told to draw a picture of yourself doing the job you want to do as an adult. And I was quite a people pleasy child. So I was like, what would people, you know, what would my teacher be impressed that I want to do? And I was like, a nurse. That's a good job to have. So I drew a picture of myself as a nurse. And then I thought, my mum won't be pleased with that. So I drew on the facing page, I drew a picture of myself as a racing driver, which I don't even like Formula One, but my mum did. So I guess to that extent, I was raised a feminist.
And early on, already thinking about your audiences. And
yep. Got to keep the people happy all the time.
And when did that signifier of feminist become, you know, forgive me, I might be projecting, but my understanding is that it's been a real thread through your life and work. When was it something that you felt like, actually, this is I have some ownership of this. This is going to be important in my life.
I guess I'd always been interested and drawn to feminist ideas, and I was certainly very attracted to women who were, if not feminists, then women who'd chosen to live difficult and interesting lives. You know, I got really interested in Sylvia Plath and Dorothy Parker when I was a teenager. I got obsessed with George Eliot when I was at university and nearly did a doctorate on her, which didn't work out for reasons we can come back to. So these women who were choosing to live, you know, lives that were against the values other people might expect of them were really interesting to me. And I was also always kind of obsessed with Margaret Thatcher. I wrote some of my sixth form history coursework on her, actually. And just this, seeing her kind of try and solve the problem of being a woman in public life was incredibly interesting to me. Even when I was a kid and watching the news, I just found it fascinating. Who was this person and how was she constructing this version of herself? And I think by the time I was a student, I certainly felt a bit skeptical and alienated from feminism in some ways. And a lot of that came down to the fact that I was basically being a cool girl. And some of it came down to the fact that it was a, you know, quote unquote, post-feminist era. And feminism itself was not very strong in the 90s to the early noughties. But I would have identified myself as a feminist on the grounds that, you know, I believe in equal pay for equal work. I believe in maternity rights. I believe in abortion rights. These are really important things to me. But really, my understanding of what feminism is as an intellectual tradition grew enormously after I had this kind of confrontation with trans politics. And I was trying to work out why does this sit so ill with me? What is intellectually wrong with this position? Which kind of initiated a massive sort of intellectual project of reading feminism, often reading feminist works for the first time, because even though I'd encountered feminist theory at university, it was quite a narrow strand, actually. You'll be amazed to hear that the kind of feminism humanities academics are interested in is not actually that engaged with the blood and guts of female experience. Yeah, there's a lot of Judith Butler and not a lot of anything else, which is unfortunate because I really don't like Judith Butler. And honestly, that was one of the most exciting intellectual experiences of my life, reading these thinkers, reading these works, coming to understand feminism, not just as a sort of a fluffy identity that you can attach to yourself, but as a political tradition that you can engage in, that you can be part of formulating, that you can agree or disagree with various parts of, and that is alive. You know, it's not a Fawcett Society t-shirt. It is a set of thinkers who have specific ways of understanding the world, which engage with other traditions like, you know, socialism, Christianity, liberalism, all of these things. And that was fascinating to me. Number one, because it just is fascinating. But number two, because I thought, bloody hell, actually, you know, the fact that I have never grasped feminism in this way before was basically sexism. The fact that I didn't understand feminism up until my 30s. And, you know, after a lifetime of feeling attached to the label of feminist is probably one of the most clinching instances of why feminism should exist in my life.
I want to ask you to say a little bit more about that period at university and what you referenced there, but with the full caveat that one of the things we can talk about is privacy and in the public and the way women's stories can get taken out of their hands and made into other things. But you referenced working essentially as a cool girl at a time, which is very key in your book, where the discourse about women and bodies were in a complicated place. Are you happy to say a bit more about that time? And if you're not, that's totally fine.
Did you say cool girl or cool girl? Because I may have just
That's why I wanted to dig cool into
girl.
It a bit more.
Yeah, no.
I maybe cool missed a key girl. Part of your biography.
No, it's fine. I sound much more interesting than I really am.
Wow, I just gave myself like 30% more edge. So that makes more sense. Tell me a little bit more about that time when you were at university, because I know that these kind of gossip blogs and the cultural analysis that you did later was very formative in that time.
Yeah. So Well, the big thing that actually happened when I was at university and the reason that I'd never finished writing my doctorate was that I got pregnant and decided to have a baby when I was 20. I was talking to a friend about this a while ago who has a podcast, so he was interviewing me for his podcast, and he said that was quite a radical thing to do, and I thought, was it?
Did it not feel like that at the time?
At the time, it certainly wasn't what I'd ever expected I would do in that situation. I thought, you know, I thought I was terribly grown up, and I'd had these conversations with my boyfriend, who's now my husband, about what we would do if I got pregnant. We're like, oh, you know, like definitely have an abortion. That'd be, you know, the only sensible thing to do when you're at university. And, you know, we both had big life plans and stuff we wanted to do. And then I did get pregnant. And I told my parents, and my mum said, well, whatever you decide to do, we'll support you. And I thought about that for about 24 hours. And I thought, well, actually, you know, I know I want to have children, and I want to have children with the man I'm with and who I'm still with. So incredibly, I wasn't wrong. And I want to have this baby. I was in my second year of university when that happened. Took a year out between my second year and my third year, and then went back, finished my degree, did a master's, got funding for a doctorate, and decided at that point with my partner that because we were both planning to be academics at that point, and we'd seen our peers who'd gone into academia. We'd seen what kind of lives early career academics live. I remember my master's thesis supervisor was living in Sheffield and teaching there, and her husband was in Southampton, and they wanted to start a family. And, you know, like you literally can't if that's the position that your career's put you in. And so we kind of decided there's maternity leave built into this funding and paternity leave built into the funding we've got. So we'll have a second kid now, and then we don't have to wait until our mid 30s and have like a 15-year gap between our children. That turned out to be the thing that was biting off more than I could chew, or certainly, because I'd moved from Sheffield to Oxford to do my doctorate, certainly the supervisor I had considered it to be biting off more than I could chew and stopped supervising me after I said I was pregnant.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a cool supportive. Child bride. It was bad. It was really bad. And he asked if my husband was the parent of both my children. It was so horrible.
Dear Lord.
I would say in my life experiences, that's definitely one in the not great column.
Hi, I wondered if I could ask for your help. You may have noticed that we've been doing a lot of work behind the scenes to make this channel more beautiful, more enriching, more thought-provoking, and more life-giving. But 87% of you watching on this channel are not yet subscribed. So I wondered if you would just hit the little subscribe button. It means that you'll get these really thoughtful conversations in your feed, and it will also help other people find us. So I often do this when I'm prepping someone. I have kind of like working hypotheses. And when I asked you about when the identity of feminist became real for you, I think I was projecting, because for me, it was when I had children. It was the, oh, this is the big glaring thing. How much was that? How much did becoming a mum relatively young for your education level change you, do you think?
Almost certainly loads and loads. I mean, in terms of feminism, it certainly hardened me against the kind of feminism that I was being exposed to in academia at the time. And it was actually incredible to, you know, years later, start reading people like Mary Daly, for example, who's really interested in the sort of, you know, blood and guts of the female experience. I was like, you know, whew, wasn't getting this in my post-structuralism seminars. This wasn't happening at all. I think it made me, I don't know, it made things harder. It was certainly was a decision that meant, at least at that point in my life, I was, you know, playing life on the hardest setting that I could have chosen. It meant that I had experiences and encounters that, you know, wouldn't have happened otherwise. So it meant that we spent, I think, 2 years living in a really run-down, impoverished part of Sheffield, because that was where we could afford to get a flat. And I certainly think that knocked some of the smugger edges off of my kind of smug middle-class liberalism, because it did mean encountering people who were genuinely having very tough, very difficult lives. I remember after we moved out, we'd had to, still a source of pain to me, in fact, now I tell this story, because we were moving down south, we were moving somewhere smaller, and we'd been given loads of furniture when we got together, because everyone was being, you know, everyone wanted things to be as nice as possible for us. But one of the things we'd been given was a set of very nice, slightly faded John Lewis sofas, but they were three-seaters, so they weren't going to sit in our new place. So we'd had to leave them outside to be tipped. And I went back up and I, to do something, I can't remember what. And while I was there, I popped to the old flat and I went to call on our neighbours who'd had kids about the same age as us, and they were, he worked in a factory and she didn't work, and I lost touch with them after that anyway. But I went in and there was all my bloody furniture. There was my, there were my sofas, and there was my broken IKEA table that they'd fixed, and I just thought, oh, like, you know, like, my hard life is, you know, still several notches up from how hard these people are having to work to get by. And that kind of thing was, you know, instructive, I would say.
Yeah. Tell me, what is the upskirt decade?
Oh, okay. So the upskirt decade is, very roughly, not a decade, first of all, which is a bad name on that count. But it starts around 1998. It ends around 2013. And it's the name that I used in my book Toxic for this era of really intense, really invasive celebrity that was very much focused on young women. Britney Spears, Lindsay Lohan, Paris Hilton. Women who became the fodder of gossip blogs, and who were presented as, you know, these trashy sluts who are no better than they ought to. And the reason I found this, the idea of the upskirt photo, which is basically the sort of, I mean, shamefully and awfully, it's like the signal media product of this time, is because, so upskirt photos were often published on websites and in magazines, and they were supposed to show how, you know, dreadful and awful and attention-seeking these women, in fact, were. And actually, the way that these photos were taken, and what you couldn't see within the photos, is that they would be taken by a paparazzo who would be literally lying in the gutter, aiming a camera up a woman's skirt, trying to get this picture. And that, to me, it's kind of exemplified the whole decade, right? It's this period where the media does awful things to women and then encourages the public to blame the women for the things that are being done to them. And, you know, the reasons that the upskirt picture was possible in that period was, number one, because digital technology had moved on so that you have these fast light cameras that you can, in fact, get down in the gutter and take pictures with in that way. You've also got instant distribution of these pictures, meaning that you have a very rapacious market for paparazzi images. And they can then be distributed via blogs and websites, which, because the legal environment had in no way caught up to the privacy concerns that the internet created, were really unconstrained in terms of what they were publishing and what, you know, stuff that we would now correctly call revenge porn was being published on pretty mainstream outlets, you know, places that paid their taxes and, you know, had actual employment packages for staff were publishing these pictures.
There was you mentioned, I can't remember which broadsheet it was, that wrote a very detailed, essentially, review of the Paris Hilton sex tape. Was that right?
Mm. Yeah, New York Magazine, which is, you know, now very liberal, very progressive in terms of everything that entails outlets. When the Paris Hilton sex tape, which she did not consent to being released, she fought its release in every possible way. But it was leaked onto the internet. And New York Magazine, live blogged themselves basically having a watch party of it, which is
so gross.
It's so gross and it's so hard to reconcile now. You know, this is basically people who are sitting around a computer watching porn at the office, which you're a bit like, was that okay? But actually it was relatively normalized, and there was not a very strong sense of this division between, or of how we should manage the collapse of the division between public and private that the internet had created. Because, you know, if you watched someone sitting at the desk next to you reading a pornography magazine, I think you would have been, you know, you would have felt few questions about saying, well, that's not okay. You take your copy of Hustler away from the office. You don't do that. That's for your living room. That's not for here. But the fact that the internet meant these things were suddenly, you know, these worlds suddenly collided, and it made it very, you know, the boundaries between these worlds collapsed. And because privacy is a really gendered concept, one of the things I realized while I was writing Toxic is just how much privacy law is built around this idea of the default male, and the ways in which privacy affect women differently were not accounted for at all. So there was a case of upskirting against, I believe, I think it was a 16-year-old girl who was the victim of this upskirting. It happened in a branch of Target in America. And she was wearing a skirt, and the guy who did it was stopped by the store security. He confessed what he'd done. He said he'd seen a documentary about upskirting and decided to go and try it himself. Oh my God. Goes to court, and eventually kind of proceeds through the court system, and it is finally thrown out by an appeal judge. And the appeal judge's conclusion is that this girl was in a public space, and because it was in a public space, she could not have had a reasonable expectation of privacy. And it's that idea, the reasonable expectation of privacy, and this idea that if you're in public, it doesn't extend to, you know,
your crotch.
Inside your clothes, because you're in public. You know, transparently, that is not something that's going to affect men in the same way, right? Because men don't wear skirts, men don't wear clothes, and men are not subject to this kind of intrusion in the same way, because it is a thing that it's kind of sexualized aggression that men perform against women. It doesn't happen in the other direction. And privacy law, not just in America, not just in this specific state, but globally, was totally, totally inadequate to contending with this situation. And women were really hung out to dry for a very long time until the law caught up.
I imagine lots of people have said this to you, but it was a strange thing reading your work about this, because I was at university in this period, and late teens university and early working life. And it made me realize how much I took as normal, like, Playboy bunny t-shirts and yeah, the upskirting was a thing that I was obviously like aware of and not especially outraged by, and managed to tune out quite a lot of it, but was very aware of this formative cultural story about women being either too fat or too slutty or too old or just wrong.
It was incredible. The things that came up in my book, Britney Spears being called a fat pig, or rather quoted allegedly calling herself a fat pig in papers when this was in 2008. If you look at pictures of Britney in 2008, just smoking, just like, there's no spare Britney. There's a Chris Rock routine that he did after Janet Jackson's, Super Bowl wardrobe malfunction. And like the punchline of this is that she's 34 and nobody wants to see a 34-year-old titty. Yeah, 34? That's like, that's no age. So as you say, too fat, too old. And there was a terrible, terrible lack of care and consideration for young women as well. So one of the most awful things I came across, and I think it was the last piece of research I did, and I remember kind of finding this and sort of slamming my laptop shut and being like, I'm done. I don't want to think about this world anymore. The website Fleshbot, which was part of the Gawker Empire, which was very influential, very significant network of blogs, included Jezebel as well, and was set up by the English journalist Nick Denton. Fleshbot was the porn / sex industry outlet. And Fleshbot was leaked a picture that purported to be Vanessa Hudgens, the star of High School Musical. They didn't have any identification on this. If it was Vanessa Hudgens, she was definitely underage, definitely under 18. And what Fleshbot did with this picture of, as far as they were concerned, a completely anonymous teenage girl, was publish it on their website. And it doesn't exist on the internet anymore. I was able to track down the page using the Wayback Machine. So that was kind of how I substantiated it. It was a time when it was not considered career-ending to publish a picture that was definitely of a young girl, definitely not taken or distributed with her consent. And turn that into, salacious entertainment.
For profit,
yes.
Yeah. And you write about Aliyah. I've never said her name out loud, I've realised.
Aliyah. Did I didn't know wrong? Until I wrote the book. Aliyah. I watched loads of documentaries about her and I was like, oh, now I know.
Yeah. Who was underage and was clearly the victim of sexual abuse by a famous R&B star.
Yeah.
And no one... this was sort of common knowledge. The thing I really felt, and you've talked about cultural poisoning, and I think a lot about cultural stories and the formative power of the media and the stories that we consume to set our norms, our moral norms. What is a human being? What is a good life? What is inappropriate appropriate or inappropriate? Could you say a bit more about that idea? Because as you've written, my general feeling is, how did we let this happen? Like, how did everyone go, of course it's normal for us to be just weaponizing misogyny for profit and watching women's mental health crumble before our eyes? Various of the women you wrote about committed suicide. Like, what's going on?
It was a period of... The noughties in particular were a period of institutionalized cruelty. And I think there was a real... sense of nihilism in the air. One of the things I was kind of baffled by at first when I started working on the book was that obviously 9/11 happens in my period, but it doesn't seem to do anything. There isn't like any way in which it feels like 9/11 sort of shaped or changed the culture. Obviously there are things like you know, there are films which are very directly about it. There are things like the Battlestar Galactica miniseries, which is obviously kind of an analogue for America Under Attack in this way. So it's not as if the worlds of entertainment and media, which is the only world I'm interested in, was completely impervious to 9/11. But this is something that's so catastrophic that meant the, you know, the Anglosphere, which is mainly what I write about because I don't speak any other languages, was, you know, dragged into various wars essentially as a result of this throughout this period. And yet it didn't seem to have left much of a mark on the culture. And I came away thinking that actually the consequence of 9/11 was this feeling of nihilism that hangs over the decade, this feeling that nothing matters, everything is chaotic and brutal, and that everything is meaningless. Because if you take on the kind of whole meaning of what happened, and one of the things that I think is really important, I don't know whether I kind of conveyed this enough in the book, but I think it's really important to understand 9/11 happens to Manhattan, and media culture spills out of Manhattan. So the people who lived under a cloud of human remains were the people who were making media in lots of cases. Of course you come away feeling cynical and like reluctant to engage with the reality of human feeling and responsibility. Was a really, certainly if you'd been adjacent to that, I think it couldn't not leave a mark. There's an incredible quote from Tina Fey, who was the head writer on Saturday Night Live, huge, huge cultural engine, where she just talks in this New Yorker profile about how she was having recurring nightmares about fighting terrorists hand to hand after 9/11. And I just think that's there in the background, and it creates this feeling of nihilism, this feeling that everything is permissible because nothing matters. And the people that lands hardest on, you know, any period of libertinism or like perceived moral riot is always going to land hardest on women.
Mm. That's interesting. Any period of libertinism is always going to land hardest on women. I'd like to come back to that, but I want to ask about how the cultural stories have changed. We're sort of, it's sort of easier with a bit of distance to see the terrible story that my generation and a generation of women were raised with. What would you say is the story that's being told now? You use this great phrase that sort of celebrity women and these media portrayals are kind of divination, that in the entrails of the reputations of those women, we hunt for clues about what a woman ought to be. So what's the story that's being told now about what a woman ought to be?
Oh, well, I probably won't know that definitively for another 15 years. I think women who are in the position of celebrities now have access to, doesn't mean they're always able to exercise, but have access to more control over their lives and images in some ways. So, Charlie XCX is a brilliant example of this, the way that she has run the BRAC campaign and the way that she, she sings about, talks about her private life. That is part of her art, but she's only presenting as much of it as she wants to or she feels comfortable with. I think that's really interesting. If you look at the way someone like Chapel Roan, who, I don't know how or whether she's ultimately going to be able to reconcile herself to what being a celebrity means, but she has been really explicit about the stuff she's not happy or comfortable with in terms of celebrity. She has said, you know, she doesn't want people coming up and touching her. She wants people to recognize that when she's having downtime, she's having downtime, and she will not be engaging with fans. And the really interesting thing is that the response to that was almost universally positive. And the response from her fandom was very much like, well, we don't want those fans who act like this. We're going to like oust them from our group because they're behaving in a way that we consider inappropriate and unacceptable. And that's a huge change. This recognition that even if you're famous, you are in fact entitled to say that you've got boundaries and you've got times when you're not publicly available. That was not something that was available to female celebrities in the noughties at all. You were deemed to be available all of the time. And because you didn't have the option of controlling and curating your own profile via social media, if your job was being famous, then you were going to have to engage with the press in some way. You were going to have to court the paparazzi to some extent, which put you in this really invidious position. Like you would, you know, sometimes you'd want to be photographed and sometimes you would not. But the industry had no interest in helping you, you know, control those boundaries and set any limits around when you were available to it. That's a huge change. There's a whole set of language that we now have for talking about forms of abuse that didn't exist when they would have been useful to the women I was writing about. So revenge porn, I think that starts to come into use around 2007. Way too late for women like Pamela Anderson or Paris Hilton, you know, who have already been completely revenge porned and completely shamed for that. Language of fat shaming, body shaming, which is, you know, complicated in some regards, but very useful for pushing back against the, you know, circle of shame culture. If you remember Heat magazine and the red circle of shame around, yep, body hair, cellulite, lumps and bumps, anything that was, you know, imperfect about a woman. That's an incredibly helpful thing to have access to. Grooming as a concept, which is now, in fact, undergoing a whole mission creep in terms of the way people use grooming. But that only starts to come into use, general use, again, in the 2000s. And it changes the way we think about people who are in the situation that Aaliyah was in, for example. And it means that you suddenly have a language that isn't seeing girls as, you know, quote unquote, Lolitas or temptresses, even though that's, you know, even though Lolita and Lolita isn't a Lolita, but that is a whole, that's another thing. And it means you have this framework that people can apply to these situations and say, oh, you know, like this older man has been cultivating this girl for sex. That's grooming. And I, you know, and the word grooming designates this whole realm of moral wrongdoing. It is transformative to have a vocabulary to describe those harms. And it's only been developed over the last few, you know, decade or so. And the other thing that's changed really significantly, actually, there's a great article in the magazine Reason about this that I revisited this week. We are way more intolerant of power differential relationships, but specifically age gap relationships. This idea of the sort of sexualized teenage girl strikes people as really, really ick now. People are not comfortable with it. You know, the idea of Britney Spears, actual teenager in sexy school uniform, I am not sure you would get that through a record label anymore. I don't think people would be drawn to that at all. Obviously, set against that, you've got the fact that the internet has generated a whole vast and repugnant body of actual paedophilia. You've got the fact that social media encourages young girls, sometimes their families, to sexualize themselves for engagement/profit. So it's not as if that issue has been vanquished, but within mainstream public life and within general morality, we are so much more intolerant of the idea that you can have a relationship between not just an underage girl and a man of the age of majority, the, you know, even relationships between adults, you know, like people can be very disapproving of relationships between people in their early 20s and a 40 something man, I think would get quite a lot of opprobrium. And that's really interesting to me. And I think it is, when you look back at this period and the period I write about, and when you look at the sexualization of young girls, it's really important to remember that it was normalized in a lot of ways. And we did not have the same sort of moral safeguards around age gaps that have become prevalent in the last decade or so.
So looking back at this decade, it just seems to me to be like porn norms suddenly enacted in mainstream culture, right? Young girls, pigtails, crotches. And I write about porn, and I have had the experience of realizing that actually have been raised in this decade as a kind of educated, feminist, politically confused person, coming to a very strong sense of wanting to name how much porn has a role in this cultural poisoning, right? That it's like a lab leak happened when porn was not on the shelves anymore, that was not constrained anymore, and its worldview suddenly colored everything. But you're kind of, I'd love you to reflect on it, because you're sort of, my instinct is your kind of political liberalism has, you know, remained sort of broadly where you'd place yourself. Is that fair?
Oh, no, yeah, I am a liberal, like, you know, John Stuart Mill liberal. I'm very freedom of speech, freedom of expression. You know, I think sometimes
talk to me about that, because this is the thing I'm interested in. Like, for me, as someone who is a Christian, is politically confused, but it gives me permission, because people still think I'm like super judgy, but it gives me a position from which to sort of argue the treating people like objects is wrong, because humans are made in the image of God, and porn almost always is treating people like objects, so we should be cautious of it because there is a soul danger, and by the way, it's usually women that are harmed. Talk to me about how you land on porn, given that.
Oh, porn's awful. I mean, porn is, as an industry, porn is, I have come to believe, inherently and inevitably exploitative and expropriative of human value. So one of the things that happens during the noughties is obviously pornography moves online. And you go from this situation where it's sold through, you know, magazines, DVDs, cassette tapes, whatever, to the tube sites, like X-Hub and Pornhub. And they essentially, they just gut the industry. So in as much as there is a functioning porn industry, it is pulled to pieces by these hub sites, because these hub sites make their money from people, men, watching whatever content they've got. It doesn't make any difference to them whether this content is infringing someone else's copyright. So loads of copyrighted pornography is uploaded to these. It destroys the porn industry. Then the biggest tube site owner, MindGeek, starts buying up the studios. And there's this period where people who are still trying to work within the quote-unquote legitimate porn industry are making content. They're owned by MindGeek. So when their content is uploaded against their copyright, is pirated onto MindGeek hubs, MindGeek is like, we simply don't care. We're just going to keep ripping you off because we own you. And that, I think, is quite a good, just kind of sums up the attitude of the pornography to humans and human value. And it simply is an industry that treats people as things. I remember, I think Jenna James was like the spokeswoman of the, like, you know, confident, go-getting porn star when I was growing up. And then Jenna James wrote her autobiography, and actually it was all very sad and awful, and she'd been abused before the industry and abused after, and that was awful. And then after that, a woman called Sasha Gray became the kind of spokeswoman of the porn industry, and she specialised in gonzo stuff and like, apologies to listeners, but things like throat fucking and very like violent and disturbing to watch sometimes acts. And she did a lot of interviews about how she loved the industry, well, how she loved making money in the industry, and she was very self-determined. And then she just dropped out of the industry completely. She's been basically absent from public life. So that was weird as well. In the tens, you had, James Dean, EEN. He was presented as this poster boy of pornography, and this like acceptable heartthrob comes out of BDSM porn, but you know, girls love him and they love putting gifs of him on Tumblr. And then he is called out by multiple co-stars and women who's been in relationships in and accused of sexual assault, which he denies. You know, if you've kind of lived long enough to see all these various cycles of pornography normalization followed by the apparently inevitable collapse of that into, you know, something not congruent with the idea of normalization, I think at a certain point you just have to say, this is just what this business is like. It attracts people who have limited prospects. It is not, you know, it does not hold itself on the whole to high standards of care, copyright, intellectual property, business practices. And it hurts, you know, people are left hurt, because I think one of the kind of myths of the, I guess the stereotypical liberal attitude to sex, which, you know, I would argue is not actually a liberal attitude to sex, but whatever, is that sex is something that people can engage in at no cost, and that you can have sex, you know, sex is basically a meeting of two inert bodies and nothing happens to them as a result of it, which is, you know, a massive lie. Like, it's you. It's you being exposed to these experiences. It's you. There's an incredible line by the writer Leslie Jameson in an essay called The Empathy Exams, which is a brilliant, brilliant essay, one of my favourite pieces of writing. But she talks about her desire to have sex with a lover as wanting to court the terrible gravity of what our bodies could do. And I remember reading that and I was like, yep, that's the thing. That's what happens in sex. Like, you are, you know, you're putting yourself on the line. And even if you do it as a, you know, as a job, even if you do it for money, your body's still on the line. And the capacity for hurt, injury, loss is built into those encounters. You know, it's why it's a significant thing to do. It's why it's a meaningful thing that people care about. And if you're doing it with people who don't share that care, then it becomes, you know, tantamount to violence.
Sarah Dighton, there is so much more I wish we had time to talk about, but for today, thank you so much for speaking to me on The Sacred.
Thank you.
So we covered a lot of ground. And there was more ground I wish I had had time to cover with Sarah, because she's such an interesting thinker. The primary reflection I'm left with is what I'm often left with, which is the power of cultural stories. And elsewhere, Sarah has written about cultural poisoning and the way we need to think of the internet as a utility, as a bit like the water supply. And that sometimes the water supply is poisoned and we're just drinking it down. And that is one way of thinking about what happened in the noughties in terms of the cultural stories about celebrity and women and fame and what we found acceptable and unacceptable. And her book is really quite startling and shocking for those of us who lived through those times. If you did not, you will find it anthropologically interesting as well and be able to see how we're in a very different place, not maybe a slightly better place, but still our appetite for the humiliation and suffering of people that we don't feel are like us. And I think celebrity is one of the key ways that we dehumanize other people. Actually, we forget that they're real people. And I know that sounds like a cliche, but we really do. And I feel it. I find it when I meet people who have a big public profile that it takes me a couple of seconds for them to come into focus as a real complex, fragile human person. We need to be careful of that instinct in us to dehumanize anyone. And the rich and famous get it almost incessantly and repeatedly. And they're like, oh, let me get out my tiny violin thing. I think it's just ignorant about the things that actually make human beings suffer and the things that actually make them happy. And it often isn't a lot of money and a lot of fame. Yeah, I wanted to ask Sarah and didn't have time, but maybe I'll ask you instead about what are the cultural stories that you are letting shape you right now? What is the water supply that you're drinking from? And how is it framing what's possible, what's imaginable, who you think is an enemy, who you think is a friend, what good and evil are? There's a sort of bad old version of this that some friends of mine raised in sort of hardcore evangelical churches in the US would talk about in terms of like, you can't watch television, you can't watch films, you can't go dancing, you know, complete withdrawal from culture. And I don't think that's a healthy instinct, but I do think some care and intentionality about the stories that we are immersing ourselves in and how they are shaping us. It's really helpful. I've had to really limit who I follow, what news I read, when I read it, and trying to have a kind of reasonably critical eye on what I'm imbibing rather than just letting it sneak past the watchful dragons of my mind to shape me and change me. I was nervous about talking about porn with Sarah because she has two different formations in her, and one is very feminist and one of which is very liberal and a very kind of free speech, maximal free speech liberal. And those two things are often quite a hard needle to thread, but actually she was just very direct about porn as a harmful industry. It's hard to talk about, I think, because desire is such a universal thing, sexual desire, maybe not universal. Some people are asexual, obviously, but that so many of us are kind of, let's be honest, so many of us use porn or have used porn or are connected to it in some ways, that saying this whole thing is harming us, this whole thing is cultural poisoning, is still quite controversial. I might have really alienated a bunch of you by revealing my position on this. I hope you know that I can hold difference, that I can tolerate difference, that I don't think disagreement necessarily means disconnection. And I'm very happy to hear. In fact, maybe I'll try and get someone on who's a kind of has a different position on it. That'd be really interesting, actually, wouldn't it? Go looking for that guest. And the bit I didn't get to talk to Sarah about because we ran out of time was what happens. So the shorthand is what happens after cancellation. And Sarah sort of talks about her experiences as sort of soft cancellation because she has been freelance. And so when she started writing about gender critical perspectives, it's not like there were big calls for her to lose her job because she was a freelance journalist, but she did get lots of pieces spiked and struggled to get a book published and received quite a lot of abuse online. And, you know, you may land in a very different place from her, or from her perspectives on trans people, but that kind of wasn't the point of this interview. And I can put that aside for now. But the thing that I'm interested in, Sarah, is a lot of people, when they experience rejection from their tribe, and she's been a woman over the left, when they experience this cancellation as shorthand, something happens to them. And you really see it, that a slide from one tribe into another quite rapidly is a fairly well-trodden path, and particularly those who have come out of a liberal or progressive broadly space said something that is unacceptable in that space and are kind of ejected from it, often then find themselves needing belonging, right? Needing some people who will listen to them, taking what is usually quite an emotional response to what's happened, and finding allies of other people who that's also happened to, and really changing their views and their worldview and their outlook, sometimes quite radically. I've been paying attention to some people who have gone really moved through this process. And what's interesting about Sarah, she hasn't really. And is also cautious of this process and sees it in others and has been, I wouldn't say critical, questioning of whether this is a necessary pathway for people who diverge from mainstream opinion on one thing, that they don't therefore have to completely change team, is one shorthand for it. But I didn't really get to talk to her about that, so maybe that's for another time. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and this podcast is a project of the think tank Theos. We hope you'll check out our wider work and our sister podcast, and come find me on Substack. It's morefullyalive.substack.com. Thank you for listening, and I will see you next time. Oh.